Welcome to the Sunday Times Politics Weekly, where we talk about the week's big political stories. I'm Mike Siluma. In this week's episode, together with my guests, we will talk about the importance of public institutions and the responsibility of political leaders to support them. Also, this week, we'll try to understand what's going on in the ANC alliance following COSATU's decision to, again, support the ANC in the municipal elections.
This econ is racist.
I've never, ever been a spy.
Can the VBS bank loot?
The problem is that Pinky.
I'll never subject myself to whiteness.
Order!
I'm listening.
Can you have consistency, Honorable Chair?
Corruption was an Olympic sport. They will always win gold.
This is not a shit.
At arms, can you please come
on the
in?
Point of order.
Let's welcome now our guest, Professor Mthulisi Ndletshana, who teaches politics at the University of Johannesburg, as well as Sibongiwonke Shoba, who's the Sunday Times politics editor. Prof, let me start with you. In the last couple of weeks, we have seen a lot of shall I call it, controversy about the decision of the IEC, first to go to the Constitutional Court to see if they can postpone the election, and then secondly to reopen the nomination, the candidate nomination process alongside the voter registration process. Helen Zille, the DA federal chair, was at the forefront of the attacks on the IEC, and she seemed to have been questioning the motives of the IEC, implying collusion, you know, between the ANC and the, even collusion between the ANC and the Concord, you know, implicitly. Did she have a case?
Well, I think decisions by the IEC, especially because they affect political parties, they affect the fortunes of political parties, and in turn impact on the livelihoods of politicians, are always likely going to be contested by political parties. And they have to, really, Mike. There is no reason why any individual, really, if they don't find any reason in what a public institution says, should not question that. But of course, all these decisions are also subject to legal challenges. What is important is that once a court has ruled, showing the or affirming the validity of any decision taken by a public institution, then parties have to abide by that. So one is not concerned that an IEC decision was contested, was questioned. It's par for the course. However, in any democratic society, you always have independent arbiters who come in, such as courts. And so once a court has pronounced on the authenticity of the decision, then, you know, you expect everybody to abide by that decision. If they still attack the decision, then you have something to worry about. So I'm not worried about the DA contesting IEC decision.
You've just made a distinction between contesting using process, following, for example, someone could go to the courts, challenge, ask for a review, etc. Versus, on the other hand, just making almost going by rumor, almost, you know, or casting aspersions on an institution and its decisions, but without following through, you know, by challenging it formally. Would that not serve to undermine public confidence in the, you know, if someone as senior as a Helen Zille or any of the other political parties, whether it's Julius Malema or, you know, any of them, were to stand up because they've got followers, what would be the implication of that? Because they are not private individuals in that sense.
Well, anything said by a public figure gets some kind of attention. It gets a huge audience. And because these are adored figures, at times whatever they say is instantly believed, regardless of whether or not it's true. And politicians know that. So they exploit the gullibility of their followers. That's part of politics. However, a more discerning person would, however, realize quite soon that if a politician has a gripe and yet does not follow up that gripe with a legal challenge, for instance, then it soon becomes clear that that gripe is hollow. It's just rhetoric. And so it loses credibility. Because politicians are also wary of losing credibility. They would prefer to make statements, especially those who take themselves seriously. There are idiots out there, of course, you know, buffoons, but those who take themselves seriously prefer to make statements that are credible and that can be proven, especially if it is an accusation. So the system is a way of correcting itself. If you make a stupid statement and it is proven to be stupid, then you become a laughingstock, a butt of jokes. And so at some level, there's an obligation of politicians to only complain about legitimate issues and issues that they can take to court and prove their veracity. So the system is a way of correcting itself to some degree, obviously.
Do you think that the IEC itself could have handled the matter differently?
Thank you so much, Brother Mike. Background in this situation is very important. That the IEC had gone to the Constitutional Court after receiving a report from the panel that it appointed to investigate this matter, and they went there based on the recommendations of that report. And now it's now history that they eventually lost. Because what they wanted was to postpone the elections to next year, but they didn't get that. They didn't get what they wanted, and now we are here. Understanding from Ellen Ziller's point of view, because she says that on the IEC is that in March this year, the IEC communicated that it was ready to hold the elections in March, and then when the matter was raised, the matter of the pandemic and the possibility of the elections becoming a super spreader, then they had to appoint that panel held by the former Deputy Justice Dikgang Moseneke, and which then resulted in them going to court and having to ask the court to allow for that extension that was not granted. And Ellen Ziller says, what has changed between then and now, between March and the time that they went to court? I think Pramak, the IEC maybe should have not committed earlier and should have taken that approach of appointing that panel if there were doubts around the election, because there's always been doubts around that. I think the source of this conflict is the fact that the IEC changed positions. Initially, we were ready to have these elections, and then comes this report coming from the panel, and all of a sudden, the IEC now rushes to the Concord to say, actually, we are requesting an extension. We think that we can't hold the elections, and then we'll move them to next year. And I think that the IEC should have communicated one position on the matter from the onset. And I don't think we'd be in the situation we are in right now.
If I can just add to that, Bramaik, I think the IEC was unusually timid. They should have taken a decision from the very onset without even including Justice Moseneke, because they had done by-elections in the previous year. We had more than 150 countries throughout the world running elections. There are a lot of lessons to learn from those countries. And the IEC is a global player, so they could talk to almost everybody about what precautions to follow, this and that. They were quite timid. They did not want to take a decision which would have turned out perhaps was wrong and they would have been blamed. So they didn't want to suffer any backlash. So what they did was to hide behind Moseneke and say, Dikgang, please take a decision for us, to cover themselves, because they don't want to deal with whatever fallout that would have happened later. So that was lack of leadership, which then, once you have we had appointed Moseneke, it meant you didn't have time now. Whatever Moseneke decides, you would have had to play, to work within that limited time. And then that they made yet another bad decision. Instead of going to parliament, they went to court. And obviously, and that was a serious blunder, going to court to ask for an extension of the period of elections. When there's no law, a law prescribes that we can only have within 5 years, then you have a grace period of 90 days. That's when you need to have a new election. So there's no law that says you can have elections beyond the grace period of 90 days. So to have gone to the Constitutional Court to say extend when there's no law that enables that was ill thought out, drastically so, and unusually so for the IEC.
But someone, Prof, might say, look, the poor IEC were dealing with unique circumstances of COVID, that they had never run an election in under conditions of a pandemic, in terms of how free, of how free or unfree or less free the election might then turn out to be. You don't think that they had any grounds?
Well, Pramak, they have the benefit, as I said, of more than 150 or so countries that had done the same thing. Those countries had also not run an election under pandemic conditions. You know, so at least we had the benefit of those countries' experiences. And we had by-elections. So, I mean, they were saying prior to appointing Moseneke, they were saying, now we have a plan. We've learned valuable lessons from the by-elections. And all of a sudden, they turn around and say, oops, please, judge, come help us. I mean, that was quite timid. I think I wasn't impressed at all with that.
The prof made a distinction between, and I'm paraphrasing, between smart politicians and not so smart politicians, right? In terms of worrying about their credibility. So if after Helen Zille's performance specifically, do you think that she comes out stronger or discredited in the eyes of her own supporters?
Ramaik, she comes out discredited. I don't think South Africans should take some of the stuff that she says seriously. I was watching one interview. She's saying that the ANC, the reason why it withdrew its application, she suspects that they had a pretty astute idea of the thinking of the judges of the Concord. And she says that she does not mean that it was the judges themselves who were tipped off the ANC, but she believes that people at the Concord had tipped off the ANC. Then she goes on to say she does not have any evidence to back up her claim, which is just ridiculous for any leader who takes himself or herself seriously to go on a public platform, make such insinuations, cast aspersions on an institution like the Concord, and then expect us to take it seriously. I think she's not come out smelling of roses. And it's a very very dangerous statement to make when you are going towards an election and to cast aspersion on institutions like the Concord and the IEC, and because that creates an environment for people to doubt whatever outcome of this election. I think she won't come out smelling of roses out of this. I hope that DA voters are smart enough to ignore whatever she's saying, because in other countries, Bramike, that is good enough to ignite conflict that will go on for years. And we've just come out of a period where there was looting over a matter related to an institution like the Concord. So I think her comments were very much irresponsible.
Just off the back of what Bamagonke was saying about people, you know, the potential for people not to believe so much or to give credence to the outcome of something like an election. Should we not be holding political leaders to a higher standard in how they engage on issues like this? Because they've got people who follow them, and which gives them a lot of power and influence. To say, should we not be saying, because you've got influence, you've got a greater responsibility in how you behave and what you say?
Well, I mean, politics is also about telling stories, Ramai. And some politicians tend to exaggerate more than others. And almost all of them don't allow facts to get in the way of a good story. Jacob Zuma is fond of telling all sorts of stories. He has conspiracies and he can have you in stitches. And it's very easy to believe what he says because he puts facts that or issues or details that look similar. And out of that, he tells you that's actually the truth. We have Malema who believes that the state has all the money is to solve everybody's problem. So that's populism. These are populist leaders. You have a Helen Zille who's returned to politics, who has come back as a conservative, pandering to the prejudice of conservative right-wing constituency. And so her anti-state corruption thing works with her. Most or some of her supporters believe that this country is going down to the dogs. So she feeds them with that rhetoric. You may have a Thabo Mbeki who believes that, well, tell no lies, claim no easy victories. So, you know, he will intellectualize and tell you about Yates, and there will be some people who listen, some who don't listen. So these politicians come in different shades, right? And what they say is pretty much shaped by the constituency that they are speaking to, by what they think will appeal to a particular constituency. So it is in the nature of politics. You can hope and urge them to tell the truth because lies obviously have the potential to destabilize, as we have seen in the United States. I mean, the CNN had a poll about 2 weeks ago that about 75% of the Republicans believe that Biden stole the elections. And that's the kind of talk that gets people to resort to extreme measures because they believe the institutions are not working. It's a conspiracy. So you do want some responsible, truthful talk from politicians, but they are politicians, Premike, you know. That's what
bridge
they do.
Too far, bro.
Huh?
Bridge too far.
Yeah, exactly.
Okay. Shall we go to the next big story of the week, that of COSATU opting to once more support the ANC in elections? Smaoga, do you want to just give us the background as to what's going on there? Because I thought that because of the public sector wage dispute, COSATU might be less enthusiastic this time around.
So, Bramike, it's a debate that keeps coming up whenever there's some kind of conflict or whether the elections are coming. The unions of within COSATU have different approaches and ideas about how to move the federation forward. You can remember with the time with NUMSA, the same thing happened. They first withdrew their support of the ANC, and they were the biggest union. They had the money, but they eventually left COSATU, and they lead it up to this week's Central Committee. We heard that Nehau was actually pushing for COSATU to leave the alliance, and it is precisely because of a dispute, labor dispute that it has with the government in terms of the salaries, and there was that talk that this is the position that now was going to push in the Central Committee. Now that COSATU has come out to say it's going to support the ANC, it means that the view was defeated. But Bramike, you must remember that how is the biggest COSATU union, and it largely organizes in the public sector, and it will use that influence it has to bargain. And I think it was a strategy by Nehau to try and enforce government by threatening the ANC that they may actually pull out. But the Nehau and its leaders have are entrenched within the ANC, and they were one of the unions that are credited for making sure that President Ramaphosa was elected in Nazareth. And I think this was just a threat, and the outcome has proven that COSATU will actually support the ANC.
Prof, let me ask you this, because it's something that we have lived with for the last 27 years, just about. This idea that COSATU is critically important in an election for the ANC, and that it brings something, that extra something. Does it actually bring an extra something in an election? In other words, if COSATU were not supporting the ANC, would it make much of a difference? Or is it like a mythical kind of support thing? Or does it actually bring voters out to support the ANC?
It's real, Bro Mike. It's real, practical, and very useful. Remember, the ANC, when you have an election, you need a lot of people to vouch for you, to spread the word for you. You need them to act as volunteers. You might even require some kind of support in terms of the material that you need for the campaign. So COSATU, oftentimes they do that. And some of them, remember, are members of the ANC who are active in branches. So if they have a gripe with the ANC as COSATU, it's quite possible then that they can use the ANC membership to influence opinion against the ANC. And it also means that they will draw their support. They won't campaign. I mean, I remember with, is it NUMSA, and NUMSA being largest in Nelson Mandela Metro, when they decided not to support the ANC anymore. It was quite terrible for the ANC. And they had fights with COSATU. And because of the absence of NUMSA, the Workers' Day, May rally of 2016, if I recall well, or 2015, I think it was 2015. There was a lull in terms of political activity. So their withdrawal from ANC politics, COSATU, had a discernible impact, damaging impact on the ANC's capacity to campaign, to make itself visible. And of course, whether or not they become a credible political party, something else altogether, because NUMSA is the party, they didn't go anywhere.
Now, Prof, you're saying that COSATU does actually bring something to the party, to the table, right? What do they get in return that they could not get by themselves, as an organized force of the left, if you like, or in the economy?
Well, this whole idea that, you know, the pastures always look greener on the other side. It's true, Bro Mike, you know, because NUMSA thought that they would do well, outside of the ANC. They set up the Socialist Party. It's so obscure that I can't even remember if the name is correct. That's how invisible they've become. And they were the largest union within COSATU, made the loudest noise. But as a party, they just did not gain traction, because, you know, the African constituency, the black constituency, has diverse interests. And some of them, even though they might be critical of the ANC, doesn't mean that they necessarily want socialism now. Remember, the ANC is a centrist party. So you can't entirely blame it of having gone liberal or right wing, and that it has neglected the poor. That argument, I mean, it's giving the poor 350 now from COVID and our safety network, grants and social welfare network is massive. You can blame the ANC for not having done a lot of things wrong, but the argument that it has neglected the poor can't quite stick. And that's the argument that NUMSA had when it left to form their party, saying that they are going to promote a socialist alternative. But there's no traction for that. What that tells you is that it's a lot easier being in proximity to power so that we can whisper whatever you want to whisper. The ANC wants to have Labour as allies because it validates its rhetoric as a disciplined force of the left, the leader of the people, the masses. You know, you can't claim to lead the masses if you don't have at least trade unions behind you. So that claim is somewhat, the appeal is limited. So they do want COSATU behind them, And so even though they know that COSATU might not leave, but at times they do take those threats. They make concessions. They make concessions because they don't want to push COSATU too far because, you know, even though you don't believe that they will leave, but you don't want to create conditions for them, for that stay to be intolerable. So it works best for COSATU. I think they've figured out to stay with it. You can whisper one or two things to the ANC. You might not get two, you might just get one. And of course, some of them know that the route to higher positions in government is through the ANC. That's why they always bargain. I mean, they always bargain. COSATU party, local government, provincial, they always insist that a certain quota of post must go to COSATU. So there are personal ambitions there, salaried positions that they are yearning for. So it's not just about the workers, but it's about personal ambitions.
Okay. And Sibongakonke, the last word goes to you. The tensions that you were talking about in COSATU between Nehau and SATU, do you see them being managed effectively, or do you think that we may be heading for another splinter group out of COSATU?
I think Bramah Senate Committee is going to manage those divisions. I think they'll come out of that meeting having agreed on a lot of issues that they disagree on. Whether the intervention of the Central Committee would be able to contain it going forward, it remains to be seen, because it also linked on what the ANC government brings on the table, whether they are willing to go back to the 2018 wage agreement and implement it, and whether whatever they bring on the table as an alternative really satisfy Nehau and these constituencies, but it also depend on the interest of the leaders of Nehau, as the prof has stated that it's also about the leadership interest and whether what they are being promised is enough for them to say, no, actually we are now withdrawing from this position and we are 100% behind the ANC led alliance.
Okay, let's wrap it up there for this week's episode of the Sunday Times Politics Weekly. And I'd like to thank our guests for this week's conversation, Professor Mcebisi Ndletshana, who teaches politics at the University of Johannesburg, and Sibongakonke Shoba, who's the Sunday Times Politics Editor. And by the way, you can find a podcast of this conversation on iona.fm, Spotify, Google Podcast, Apple Podcast, or wherever you prefer to source your podcasts. Until next time, we still say stay safe, sanitize, wear the mask, and avoid crowded places. I'm Mike Siluma, signing off.